Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Welcome to this podcast on behalf of UK Investor Magazine. This particular edition is brought to you by FundEdge, which is a recently launched AI-powered platform that allows investors to make informed choices. Very pleased to say we're joined by Lord Peter Ricketts this morning. I am going to embarrass you. I'm really sorry about this, but I'm going to read. I'm going to read your CV, and if there are little bits, I'm sure they'll come out if I forget anything. But you are a retired, I think, a senior British diplomat and life peer. You were the UK's ambassador to France. You were a national security advisor in 2010. You were chairman. Need I go on? You were chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee under Tony Blair, and so on and so on. Let me ask you first. I mean, we live in very changing times, as you well know. How do you think the rest of the world regards the UK at the moment?
Well, thank you for having me on. And that's quite a question to start with, because the rest of the world is a large place and there will be different angles in different places. I think the UK still maintains a reputation as a country that has taken international relations seriously. I mean, we've got our colonial legacy, our presence around the world, communities from every nation in the UK, a long track record of investing in, trading with all parts of the world. And that is still there. I think the further away you are from the UK, the more weird the whole Brexit saga seemed. I think the UK, from a long way away, looks like it's in the European bloc of nations. And so I think that was, people paused and couldn't really understand what was going on. But I think the way that the Prime Minister and the government the last 3 or 4 years have dealt with Ukraine, that Britain in a way has gone back to its classic role of helping to lead certainly Europe and international opinion towards solutions to problems. That's what we've classically done. So I think our reputation is still there, but it's taken a considerable knock over the last decade.
Lord Ricketts, while we're there, your last big diplomatic appointment was as ambassador in France. And I think it coincided more or less with the evil or fun day, whichever we want to look at, of the 10th of June, 2016, when Brexit was announced. You were in Paris at the time, I imagine. No, not.
Now, I had left in the January.
Oh, right.
I won't claim that I saw Brexit coming and got out before it, but I had left.
No, the question I wanted to ask, did it come as a massive shock to the European community?
Yes, it did. Absolutely. And indeed, for the last couple of years, European leaders like Angela Merkel, like François Hollande, were trying to persuade David Cameron not to go ahead with a referendum. I mean, in France, they know about referendums, and they have a lot of experience. And indeed, the foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, had been the leader of the campaign to say no when they brought the so-called European Constitution to France. And indeed, the French came within a squeak of saying no, which would have been a major upheaval in the EU. So they're all saying, for heaven's sake, don't have a referendum on a huge question where nobody really is informed about the facts. And so I think they regretted it had gone ahead, and most of them were shocked and very disappointed at the outcome.
Do you think, just to finish this one off, that if Angela Merkel had given David Cameron a bone, just a small bone to chew on, it might actually have turned out very differently? She gave him, when he came back from visiting her, what appeared to the general public to be absolutely nothing.
Honestly, I don't think it came down to details of what was on offer in the final package. I think if it had been enough to decide not to have a Brexit referendum, fine. But if he'd gone ahead with a referendum with a slightly improved offer from the Europeans, honestly, I don't think it would make any difference. I think people didn't vote on the detail. They voted with their instinct, you know, with their gut. And at that point, the whole thing was lost.
Right.
How important do you think our relationship with France is, particularly?
I think it's very important at the moment. I mean, given how difficult relations with Donald Trump's America have become, how unreliable America now is in an ally, the French are the other main European country with a track record of deep engagement in international affairs. They're permanent members with the Security Council with us, with a tradition of having active armed forces, using them to defend their national interest. Nuclear weapon powers like we are, there's an awful lot in common between us and France when it comes to international affairs. And 9 times out of 10, we are in agreement. So I think there's a lot to be said, and I'm very glad to see that the relationship after a pretty rocky period over Brexit and then the Boris Johnson premiership is back to something much more stable. And I welcome that very much. And just to celebrate that, I'm the government special envoy for the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry, which is coming and will be on exhibition from September, which is going to be a fantastic sensation, I think, and a real piece of cultural diplomacy between the UK and France, reminding us we have a shared history going back at least 1,000 years.
Yes, yeah. I saw it 20 years ago in Bayeux, and it is a phenomenal thing. But I just wanted to add a little something on that. President Macron's situation politically is quite precarious, and there may be issues in a couple of years' time, whether it goes left or right. It's very hard to tell in France. Do you still think that the relationship will be maintained, whoever it is?
Of course, he's not the only political leader in Europe whose position is precarious at the moment. I mean, our dear Prime Minister, very hard to see how long he will be in the job. Yeah. And Friedrich Merz in Berlin has all kinds of problems as well. So we're going to have an election in France in May. Of course, Macron has done his 2 years, can't stand again. Right now, it looks like the sort of populist right under Marine Le Pen are the likely winner, especially if the centre-right and centre-left go in divided with a whole plethora of different candidates. If they win, and it could be Marine Le Pen or her number two, Jordan Bardella, depending on whether Marine Le Pen is excluded by the French courts, if they win, that will be a seismic shock to Europe, yes, because they are much more populist, for example, than Giorgia Meloni in Rome, who has proved to be obviously very, very right-wing in her domestic policy, but pretty internationalist in the way she's gone about the EU and international crises. But a France that went down the Marine Le Pen line would be a very uncomfortable partner in the EU.
So we've talked about the United States a little, talked about Europe, and talked about France. You seem to have, if I may put it like this, a relatively burgeoning broadcasting career right now. Do you feel as though your skills as a diplomat and your skills of international politics could bring government and business together in this country? Because that is what's clearly missing, isn't it? There doesn't appear to be any discourse between government and business. Or if there is, it's very, very quiet indeed. And I thought we were going for growth. I thought this government... Is there some way in which you could use your skills, do you think, from your experience of diplomacy to bring the two sides together?
I mean, I would very much like to feel I can help a bit to build bridges, as you say, between the world of Whitehall and Westminster and the world of the city, even if that the financial community is now in the West End as well. I mean, that does feel a very distant relationship, yes. And politicians tend to say when they come in, we want to have a much closer relationship with business. You know, we're going to be consulting business at every turn. Mm. And then the pressure of events and the crisis management they have to do with their own political party often drives that into the background. So, I think there's a real place for professional diplomats. By the way, there's not many of them in the US at the moment. They don't seem to be anywhere near trying to resolve the crises in the world. That's being done by amateurs, basically, which is not working very well. Mm. But I do think if one of our key priorities is growth, along with protecting our national security, of course we need to be talking to business. And there's another reason as well, because in a way, in the last decade or so, geopolitics, my world, and geoeconomics, your world, come together. Now, any event anywhere will shock the global supply chains, will shock the global economy. We've seen a few missiles landing on petrochemicals in the Gulf, immediately spike interest rates, risk inflation, suddenly oil and gas and fertilizer shortages in many countries. So what is happening in the world of diplomacy has an immediate impact on the markets, on financial services, on businesses. Therefore, they need to be much closer together. And I think we need to have a much closer dialogue between those who are trying to manage businesses in this chaotic, uncertain world and those who are trying to cope with the politics.
Even non-experts would agree with you, wouldn't they? I mean, it's clear that geopolitics has that sort of effect on the markets. Why is this so far away from the way government actually thinks in this country? Is it simply because of events, dear boy, and so on?
There's a bit of that, events, yes. But I think governments get it, basically. And I think increasingly the impact of international events on what happens at home, the domestic impact on inflation, on food shortages, on all that, I mean, that comes home very quickly. So I think they understand it, but actually tackling it is a very different thing. Actually, being able to get around the problems of tariffs from America, of Chinese dominance in certain export areas, of restrictions in the Gulf. I mean, these are all very, very difficult issues to tackle. So I think politicians are aware of the problem, but most of them have no background in business or finance and very little, honestly, very little sense of which levers you pull to have any effect.
Yeah, I mean, certainly going before the July 24 election, I mean, what I call the smoked salmon bagel round, that
used to the prawn cocktail round. Well, I think, yes.
Prawn
it's updated.
Yeah, slightly updated. I think, you know, that the Prime Minister Starmer and Jonathan Reynolds from business and Rachel Reeves from the Treasury, the city was very, very impressed. But it gave the impression that the information that was exchanged went in one ear and out the other, because all we've seen is anti-business legislation in the course of the last 2 years. And we think it's going to cost us very dearly. Political pressure strike me as number one for any political party rather than the business community or the economic issues that they might actually damage. This is where I think things should be, you know, rectified. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid that the priority for politicians will always be keeping their coalition together that governs. I mean, you know, it can be coalitions within one party, and we've seen within the Labour Party, although they have a very large majority, there are many different strands, and they all have to somehow be put together to keep the government in power. So it drives that sort of party manoeuvring as the number one priority, and it drives an acute short-termism. I mean, it's all about surviving the next week or the next month or the next NHS crisis or whatever it is, rather than thinking 2-5 years ahead. Yeah. How can we help this enormous instrument, this power we have in the financial services in the UK, in the City of London? You know, if we want growth, we've got to somehow make sure the city grow and can then feed the finance to the startups around the country. But that is never the priority. It's always going to be, you know, holding your political group together, winning the next vote, coping with the next crisis coming around the corner.
One thing, if I may say so, your list was almost comprehensive, if I may say so. You missed out jobs, didn't you? This is something which we've talked about a lot before. The lack of jobs in the workforce is quite frightening in this country. What kind of country do you think that would turn us into unless somebody decides to try to solve it?
I mean, there are many different things working on that, aren't there? There's the issue of taxing jobs. There's the issue of training and supply of trained, qualified people. There's also the whole issue of AI. And is that going to suppress jobs or create new jobs or create jobs requiring different skills? So the government ought to be looking at all those, really. I mean, clearly, taxing people out of jobs is not a good idea if you want growth. Probably limiting immigration very sharply, particularly those with highly skilled immigrants, is probably not going to help growth either. And then the whole training education system to supply the workers that you guys need in the next generation, that's important too. That's a huge agenda, but it comes into my category of, you know, longer term expensive issues that you must do, but don't have an immediate effect, don't move the dial for you politically, you know, or, you know, boost GDP growth by 0.2%. From 1 month to the next.
And is this where diplomacy comes in? Perhaps that's the conversation you might need to have. This won't move the dial
they
immediately.
It strikes me they need to be focused, as Michael says. You know, they seem to move off the line. One thing that I think Jeremy Hunt said 2 years ago, and he regretted it from the Tories, was the lack of planning. There was no planning, or if there is a planning operation, it certainly eludes us.
Yeah.
Take the City of London. I mean, the City of London now, the one absolutely nailed on certainty to do well with Brexit, even if people in the country dismissed it from the larger business people. I mean, generalizing, large business doesn't like Brexit. We accept that. But if they'd looked at the City of London and deregulated and made the place really more competitive than it really was, I think that would have set a really good agenda, because as a result of this not happening, we're losing IPOs. People like Revolut and Flutter Entertainment are changing their listing from London to New York. And this is a consistent platform. Last week, the Prime Minister spoke about technology, but he spoke as if we were a big player. We're not. We should be coaxing, caressing, and looking after the small, medium-sized enterprise companies. And that's where we can make a massive contribution.
Yes, but I think you're right in saying when companies are delisting from London, they're not going to Europe. They're going to New York.
Yes, yeah.
And when I was chairing the Lords European Affairs Committee the last couple of years, we did an inquiry into where we are on Brexit. You know, what's it delivered? What more can be done? Where should we go? And there was a very clear message from our witnesses from the financial services community that we don't want any further closer involvement with the EU in regulation. Very different to the the trade in goods,
yes, exactly,
or the trade in food or plants, where, of course, they want more engagement. They want to knock down the barriers. The city were basically saying to us, leave us out of your negotiations with the EU. We are outside. We're benefiting from being outside. I think we'd rather like to be further outside than we are. So that's a very interesting distinction. And I'm not sure politicians understand that.
I don't think they do. I mean, Lord Hill, I thought, did a very good job. I mean, he made it very clear that he was very disappointed with the fact that Brexit was there. But the fact is, he put his best foot forward. And I thought he gave an extremely good agenda, which the government of the day, and it was the Tories then, and also the government of yesterday and the government of today, should have adopted.
Yes, but at least we do have the freedom. That's the one area where I would say being outside the EU is probably an advantage, in the financial services area, where the city can do its thing without being bound up in EU regulation. For the rest of it, and honestly, I think the rest of the economy would benefit from being much closer to the EU, perhaps even in the single market. But there was a pretty much unanimous message from this end of town that no thank you, not for financial services, which I very well understood.
One thing, before we go on to much more of the international agenda, I was going to say, ask whether you agree, that even if no one is a particular fan of President Trump, the one thing he did do was rattle Europe in the UK's cage and saying your commitment to defence is wholly inadequate. And we've obviously had this spat last week. We need to sharpen up over this, don't we? I mean, generalizing.
Definitely. I mean, yes, Trump was right to shake us hard on the fact that we've been essentially freeloading on the US for defense for the last 20 or 30 years. He's not the first US president to do that. And Barack Obama was doing it, even Biden, in much politer terms.
Yeah.
Trump doesn't do polite, of course, and he was threatening, basically, unless you are prepared to up your defense spending, you're not going to get the backing of the US. Either we pull out of NATO or the famous Article 5 mutual security commitment isn't going to apply. And that was a wake-up call. It came about the same time as Putin's after Crimea, when he was beginning really to build up his pressure on Ukraine. And those two things together, Trump on one side, Putin on the other, has forced a major, major uplift in European defense spending, much less in the UK than I would like to see. But in Germany, a huge increase. I mean, they had the fiscal space to throw several hundred billion euros at it without their interest rates spiking. Countries like Poland and the Baltic states, the ones who are really close to the Russians, are spending well over 4% of GDP on defense without noticeably being worse countries for it. So I think that we have been slow in that. The French have been slow in that. Actually, the further you are away from the front line with Russia, the less likely you are to be really putting major effort into defense spending. And I think the lack of willingness to really bite that bullet, if that's an appropriate expression, on the part of Keir Starmer and his government has now blown up in his face with the resignation of John Healey. I mean, it has really put the issue of why are we not spending enough on defense when the security of the realm is the number one priority. I mean, that's now fully on the table and they've got to deal with it.
I mean, things haven't been as bad since the Bear Pigs, have they, really? I mean, on an international basis. Michael, come kick us off on the international scene.
I'm just wondering about the thing that we seem not to understand, or perhaps we do understand and we're too scared about it. But China, do you think, I mean, they're clearly rising. There's clearly an accommodation that needs to be made. Mm. It would be nice to have them on side. We've had various spats about technology and all the rest of it. What's your feeling about China? Do you see it, as most people do, fairly opaque?
Certainly opaque. It is not a threat to us in the way Russia is. It is not trying to dominate the world. It's not trying to kind of recreate the Soviet Empire. It's a different kind of competitor. It certainly wants to be number one in Asia. It wants to be dominant in future technologies, or at least equal dominant with the Americans. So it's a different kind of beast than perhaps we've been used to dealing with, who had outright intentions on occupying territory in our part of the world. That's not China. Yes, it's a serious threat. At the same time, it's a country we have to deal with. we can't simply blank them out, as sometimes Trump has suggested in the past, before then going on to do a trade deal with them. We have to have a working relationship with them. We have to be able to talk to them. We are an enormous importer of Chinese goods, of course, and that will continue. We need to be vigilant where they're after our secrets or trying to, you know, subvert our societies or push down on criticism against China. But we need to be able to work with them. And so this slightly kind of messy policy that's developed in the UK and in Europe of dealing with China while being vigilant about China, I think is about right, actually. I don't see that there's any real alternative for a country like the UK.
I mean, certainly I've noticed, even from our standpoint, the influence of China is very much more prevalent. Even if you want to be parochial, in my block of flats, which is an enormous block of flats in West London, we have seen 8 families, Chinese families, come in from business, industry, or diplomacy into our area. So I'm very strongly feeling it, and therefore, consequently, would seriously endorse the way you think we should look after it. Because it is very, very noticeable from where I come.
We have to be open-eyed, don't we? Mm. And so the fact that there are thousands and thousands of young Chinese students in our engineering faculties in universities, that's not by coincidence, and they will have an agenda, and we need to be aware of what that could mean. But we can't pretend that China doesn't exist. We are also, in a way, more vulnerable to Chinese economic coercion because we're not in the EU. So the EU, with its clout, can at least stand up to China on anti-dumping and so forth. We are much too small to do that. And so we are caught in this rather awkward place between the Americans and the Europeans in how to deal with the vast pressures of Chinese subsidized exports of everything in our direction. That does leave us a bit more vulnerable. But yeah, I think a working relationship with China with our eyes open is where we should be.
One thing that I think really I would love to, and I think all our listeners would like to know about, is this extraordinary appraisal that President Trump has of Russia, particularly Putin, which I think most of us find completely incomprehensible. And also, could you possibly unravel, for want of a better expression, the so-called agenda for peace that is supposedly taking place between Iran, Israel, and the United States of America? Because that looks like a sack of beans to me.
Okay. Trump's fascination with Putin, I don't think it's because Putin held some deeply compromising material on him. I think it's that Trump is fascinated by strongmen. I think he sees himself as a strongman. He would quite like to be able to be leader for life and have everything with his name on it and preferably gold. And he sees that Xi Jinping in China and Putin in Russia are strong men who are likely to be there as long as they live. And he therefore finds them fascinating and likes to hobnob with them and be seen with them, while also sometimes challenging them. So I think it's that. And I think it's another worrying aspect of Trump, actually. His attachment to authoritarianism is very worrying. On Iran and all that, I mean, of course, the crisis between Israel and the Arab neighbors has been going on all my working career. Mm. And I've worked with it many times. The attack on Israel by Hamas and then the Israeli assault on Gaza, it's been desperately bad for humanitarian terms, still not settled. It's one of those half deals that Trump likes where he puts out a 20-point plan and the first point is implemented and then everybody forgets about it. And you look at a year later and nothing's happened. I mean, really nothing has happened in Gaza.
I mean, that committee's hardly met, is it?
No. And, we're heading for the same thing again on Iran. And there's a 14-point plan. I believe we're recording this before I've actually seen the text of it. But it's pretty clear. It's a sort of basic deal where Iran agrees to open the strait. The U.S. agrees to lift the blockade on Iranian ports. And they will meet again to talk about the nuclear. In other words, it winds back the clock to the 27th of February, the day before the attacks, where there was a nuclear negotiation going on. The Strait of Hormuz was open. And it's now putting things back to that, except that Iran has had massive destruction, of course, but Iran has shown it has a superpower tool in its capacity to close the Strait of Hormuz again anytime it likes and to hold those petrochemical facilities in the Gulf, enormous as they are, at risk at any time from relatively basic weapons. So Iran has come out of this strategically stronger. It's also actually now roped in Lebanon. It's made Lebanon a condition for a settlement between the U.S. and Iran. In other words, although Netanyahu hates the idea, Netanyahu is going to have to lay off his assault on Lebanon if there is going to be a durable settlement between the U.S. and Iran. So overall, I would score this as very, very much Iran's win. Of course, it'll be a huge relief to us all when the oil and gas and fertilizer starts flowing again, hopefully shortly. You know, but the threat that the Iranians could always close it again long after the U.S. armada has sailed home will hang over us. It's a new reality that we're not going to get away from.
Do you think that the idea that the 90 million people that are in Iran and where things can be hidden, that Trump grossly underestimated the damage that they would be able to receive and take? And also, in the same breath, I think it's possible that, you know, what he thought was that the regime would be overthrown, it looks stronger.
Yes. I mean, my own feeling is that Prime Minister Netanyahu persuaded Trump to go for it on the grounds that an early decapitation strike would knock the regime over. It's been Netanyahu's plan, hope, wish for 20 years to do that. And Trump is the only American president who bought that and went ahead with it. But all American presidents are seduced by air power. If you think back from Vietnam onwards, they all think that more bombing will lead to whichever country is in their firing line will succumb, capitulate. And it never happens. In fact, as we know from the Blitz in 1940, you know, aerial bombing makes you more determined to hang in there and win eventually. So, yes, it was massively miscalculated. The Iranians have clearly protected more of their key weapons than the Israelis and the Americans thought, as you say. It's a huge country, lots of mountains, lots of places to hide, and they can still hold the Gulf at risk. And one of the big issues for the next few months, I think, is where the Gulf go now. The Gulf leaders have some quite hard thinking to do. Is the alliance with America really what's going to protect them? Do they need to get closer to China? Should they get back closer to Iran? It'll be differential answers, I think, depending on which Gulf country you look at. But their sort of cozy business model of being the luxury haven for business, for the elite around the world, overlook the fact that a few miles across the water is Iran, and they are a big factor there as well.
I mean, Dubai has got a big question mark against it now. I mean, having been a haven for hundreds and thousands of British people to go over there and make their millions and the rest of it, I fear that may not be the case anymore.
No, I mean, nothing is ever quite as easy as it seems in international affairs, and everybody has more to think about now.
So is all this about energy? Is that what we're talking about? And if there were a different supply of energy, to allow energy, whatever it is, to take place, does that alter the balance of things? Because we're talking about oil, we're talking about the Strait of Hormuz and so on, but, you know, that's a very small part of where the world's going, it seems to me, right now.
Well, it's a small part unless you're in the oil and gas or indeed fertilizer business where we discover. So, yeah, a lot of Iran's leverage is because the world is pretty dependent on Strait of Hormuz for getting oil and gas and fertilizer out. And if more of it could be shipped down to the Red Sea and so on, then that would be easier, of course. But it's not just that. I mean, it's the whole Gulf state sort of approach, where you're using their massive wealth for their own purposes, sometimes to be now the intermediaries in crises. So yes, it is about energy. Energy is such a fundamental thing in our world anyway. And whichever country is in a position to supply energy has a lot of leverage. You know, the Russians have been major energy suppliers and still are, even despite all our efforts. So, and that has fueled the Russian war machine, certainly. So yeah, the disposition of energy around the world is very, very significant, including in the geopolitics.
Putin himself, I mean, he says that the Russian economy is strong enough to be able to take all the sanctions and things. Is that really the case? Or do we really think that they are under pressure? I mean, God knows how many lives it's cost and what the Russian people must be thinking now and where are they going in the future?
I mean, Putin would say that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he couldn't say anything else. He'll be the last person standing who will be defending the Russian economy. They're in dire straits, I mean, they've bent their economy out of shape completely in order to sustain the war. I think there's been no investment in the civilian sector at all. They've been starved of civilian technology, apart from whatever the Chinese have given them and what they can smuggle from the West. So in longer term, their economy is going to take, you know, years to get over this. And in the shorter term, the costs of the war in Ukraine are going up. In human lives, yes, 1.25 million people now thought to be dead or wounded as a result of that. I mean, no country can support that without some kind of, you know, backwash against the leader, especially since they've achieved precisely nothing. And on the battlefield, they did have momentum. But to enormous credit of the Ukrainians, they've more or less turned that around now. It's now become a drone based AI-fueled war where you simply can't put your head above the above the trench on the front line, and the front line is now a kind of 20-mile depth without being killed or resupply. So the fact of the highest, the most agile technology, drones, are really changing that battlefield and making it more and more difficult to be the aggressor, to move forward. It's giving the defender more and more capacity to defend. And therefore, you know, it's a ticking clock that in the end, people are going to start saying in Moscow, including the military security elite, we're not getting anywhere here. We're absolutely not achieving anything. And we must think again. And that sounds bad news for Putin when that moment comes.
So if you were between government and business, and you were using all your diplomatic skills and all the kind of skills that you've learned through your long working life, What would you be advising people to be investing in right now? If I dare ask you that question.
Well, the defense industry writ large, by which I mean the new technologies that are going to be needed to keep us safe in the next generation. I think in Europe we have some great classic defense companies, of course, but they are building the classic, exquisitely expensive platforms that you order in one decade and may come to you 2 decades later. The aircraft carriers, the fast jets, and all that. The submarines in particular. I think that the new frontier is defense electronics, is the application of AI and data to weapons and to the whole conduct of defense affairs. In the end, we can't do everything else we want to do in the country unless we can get that under control, which means more money but spent differently, I think, on the things that we learn now from Ukraine and the Iran conflict really matter, things like missile defense. For my part, that is important, and I'm sure that the whole startup AI sector is going to be vital in that. It would be quite nice to see a European AI champion emerge, whether it's in the UK or in France, I'm less worried about, but somehow we need to have some kind of, you know, ball in that game of the major, the giants, yeah, the super giants from California. And I can't see why we can't get together in Europe enough of a base of technological skills to do that. So I'd like to see the emergence of one or two champions in that area.
Final question for me. I mean, that makes so much sense. Mm. Politically and economically, the United Kingdom's at the crossroads. It's got choices now. Europe, the United States, both, a combination. How, if you had a clean white sheet of paper, where do you think we should go?
Well, first of all, it's got some major domestic choices, which somebody like me, a civil servant, really can't help with, which is, you know, how are we going to invest and spend in the future? You know, are we going to go down the route of massive welfare spending and making sure that the backbenchers of the Labour Party are happy with what we're doing for the domestic economy? Or are we going to put a lot more into defence and security writ large? I think that's a critical thing. In terms of our geographical focus, I think there's no question now that our national security lies in Europe. That's where the main threat is. Yes, NATO has been great for the last 80 years. The Americans, under any president, are now moving backwards from commitments in Europe, and the Europeans are going to have to do more. It's in our European backyard that our security and our economic future lies. So I think it's time to make some choices and to recognize that we are not a global power in the way we perhaps were in 1940. No. Yes, we need a relationship with China. Yes, we need to maintain links across Africa and Latin America. But I think if we've got limited resources, we need to focus them, and we need to focus them first on security and economic security in Europe.
If I dare say it, and there's been a documentary about Gareth Southgate and his
England,
or whatever it's called, this England.
Our England.
England. Yeah. Yeah. And what you're saying rings so true, because he gets a big whiteboard and writes on it, 1966. What happened in 1966? We won the World Cup. But that's a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. Things have changed, haven't they?
Very much so.
I mean, I'm not trying to diminish what you've said, but that seems to me to sort of sum it up, that we thought Brexit seemed to think, oh yes, we are important. We are not important, are we?
were not as important. Mm. But I don't think all these things, because I think grown-up people, Brexit made Europe very angry, made a lot of people in this country extremely angry.
Yeah. Mm.
But grown-up people, in my opinion, can get around that.
Yeah.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you agree or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think out beyond the kind of our bubble, a lot of people in the world still think Britain has a lot to offer. In the kind of crisis management we've been doing, they still think we've got great armed forces. Mm. We've got a very, very good legal system. We've got the king, the royal family. We've got culture and arts and sport and football. And people still respect the UK, even if they don't particularly like the politics at the moment.
I think this has been a wonderful chat.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been an absolute great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And David and I will be back with another podcast fairly soon. Do join us then.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.